We're almost a week from Election Day. Today, we thought we'd see how children are viewing this presidential race.
I think the elections should have more peace in them. I think it's going to end up bad in both ways. Because, like, Hillary wants war, and Donald Trump wants to build a wall and stuff.
We visit one Champaign school and talk to students and teachers there about how they're discussing this presidential race with our youngest citizens. PolitiFact Illinois joins us to talk about Senator Kirk, the endorsements he's lost over the weekend, and the Trump factor in down-ballot races. And finally, how are Cubs fans feeling after last night's must-win in the World Series?
Oh, they're going all the way now. Up until tonight, I was worried. Now I'm confident. I think they're going to win.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Happy Halloween. We had a great Cubs win last night. We're going to get to that later on in the program. But first, this has been a bizarre presidential election, to say the least. There's been a lot of emotion, a lot of discussions about topics that are tough or downright inappropriate for children. So how are our youngest citizens viewing this election? We're going to spend some time this morning with one Central Illinois school, their teachers and students. Here are some fourth and fifth graders from Southside Elementary in Champaign we spoke with this morning.
My name is Mandel Harrington. I'm in fourth grade, and what I think about the election is that it's a good thing, but you should still have the same president. But when he dies, then you could get a new one after that.
Who would you vote for if you had to vote for somebody?
I would say Obama.
Are you learning anything about what it takes to become president?
No. But I do know one thing, you need responsibility.
My name is Ian. I don't really think I'm a part of it at all, but I think the elections should have more peace in them. I think it's going to end up bad in both ways, because, like, Hillary wants war and Donald Trump wants to build a wall and stuff.
My name is Lily. I wish that Bernie Sanders could be president. My parents were voting for him, and I agree with them. I don't like what they're saying to each other. If they could say it a little bit more kindly, I would like it a lot better. But I know they're both, in my opinion, not going to be the best for president.
Thanks to Sean Newman for producing that audio for us. On Friday after school, the two teachers of those students you just heard from, Tiffany Davis and Alexis McCann, joined me in studio to talk about what they're seeing and what they're talking to about with their students. Tiffany Davis teaches fifth grade, Alexis McCann fourth grade at Southside Elementary. Ladies, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Alexis, I wanted to ask you, how has the election affected students? I imagine you've been a teacher for some time. This isn't the first presidential election you've gone through, is it?
It is your first presidential election. I'm in my third year teaching now.
How has the election affected your student?
There's a lot of questions in the classroom. Some of the questions come up informally, not in the actual classroom setting. There was one student when the election first started, and she came and asked if Trump was elected, if she would have to move out of the United States. And so I talked with them and said, you know, sometimes politicians will say certain things to try to get people to vote for them. And, you know, the way our government's set up, like, hopefully that won't happen. So, you know, there's lots of steps in place. And so there has been a little bit of fear, I think.
Fear. It sounds like a lot of emotion. I don't know if there's a lot of emotion. It's kind of, I imagine, that children are reflecting what their parents and their adults are seeing.
Absolutely.
I mean, Tiffany, for you, you're fifth grade. They're a little bit older. How are your students reacting?
Actually, pretty positively. But we watch a segment of CNN every day. It's called CNN Student News. It's actually geared more towards middle age or middle school age students, but I have the fifth graders watch it. So almost every single day right now, there's some short news clip about the election or footage from the debates. And when that first started, soon after school began, like in late August, they were very emotional initially about who they liked, who their parents liked, and sharing opinions. And I had to actually twice stop the newscast from CNN and make sure that the kids knew that we were not sharing our personal political beliefs or who we liked, or more importantly, who our parents liked or what our parents thought. And when I made that disclaimer very clear, that kind of cut it and stopped students sharing their personal stories or thoughts. And it's interesting because what 10 and 11-year-olds pick up on is small pieces of the truth, and you can tell that they don't fully understand adult issues, or maybe they've heard their parents talking about things, or maybe they've read a headline in the newspaper. And so it's kind of half-truths that come out.
And are they positive or are they negative? I mean, is it a lot of, are you feeling like you are doing a lot of anxiety, or are you just doing a lot of sort of correction of, well, they said this, but this is actually what's happening?
I would say it's more correction, although I have to, as a public school teacher, I really have to walk this fine line of not, you know, it's not my job to say what each candidate feels or certainly
what's
how
right
I
or
feel.
Wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I try to tell them that we're going to get our information on the CNN student news, and that when they have questions, they can go home and finish that conversation with their parents. And I think that's really, in the realm of public education, especially with children, that's the focus we need to take on it.
I think they're really just trying to make sense of the world. They're hearing all this discussion. They're hearing all, they're mirroring what they're seeing, but they're really trying to make sense of the world and how the election is going to impact them after. So that's, I think, where the questions are coming from. And I think once we explain to them, you know, like you're saying, you talk with your students about how the Electoral College works. And I talk with them about there's the presidential election. And before that, they have the debates. And they're trying to convince people to vote for them by presenting ideas in certain ways. And whether or not that actually happens once they're elected, it kind of depends on a lot of things besides just the president. So I think that a lot of the questioning is trying to figure out how this big world event is going to apply to their day-to-day life.
Sure. And I think that I want to get to how the civics part of this, right? Because I think that's a big part of the piece that you all are doing as educators, is just explaining to them, which frankly, I think a lot of us just learned this in fourth or fifth grade, and then we kind of forget about it. You know, maybe you have a reprise in American history in 11th grade, and if you don't study this, everyone kind of forgets like what the Electoral College does. But before we get to that, I wonder, part of the reason why I wanted to have this conversation is because a friend of mine, I saw a post that he made about how his son, who's in fifth grade, their assignment had been to watch the debates, but the teacher sent them home with a note saying, I don't think it's appropriate for me to have the children watch this anymore after the second debate because of the content of what was discussed. I think it's just too inappropriate for fifth graders to be doing that. Do you feel like you've had to draw that line a couple of times, or do you all just feel like you don't engage with the politics of what's being said and you're just trying to talk more about the process?
That's exactly right. So the students have seen footage of the debates via the CNN student news that I show. However, that's heavily edited, so you're not going to see the inappropriate content. And what we focus more on is, you know, what the founding fathers laid out in the Constitution. So what is an electoral college? And what leads up to the civic part of the whole election? So that there's a caucus. The caucuses take place in the spring. What is a caucus? Who can be involved in the caucus? And then that moves into primaries and what a primary election means. And then in the summer, we have conventions. And of course, a lot of them saw footage of the conventions this summer. So we kind of discussed the role that a convention plays and why that happens, and then how that rolls into the debates. And it in fifth grade, a lot of the focus of our reading, especially in the fall, is on persuasive articles. So we've actually had several debates in our class. They're a lot of fun. My class this year really enjoys them. But they're not debating on political topics or the candidates or anything like that. They're debating on a completely different topic.
Do they want to do that, or do they want to focus on the politics because
they feel like they're
surrounded
by debate,
it.
Period.
Okay.
Actually, so I think for them, the joy is debating. So having a different opinion from somebody else on anything, and then practicing the appropriate
justification.
Yes. And how to compose yourself in a debate.
And so for Alexis, for your fourth graders, I wonder how much is, obviously, Tiffany, you teach fifth grade, Alexis, you teach fourth grade.
Yes.
You're with them all day. You're teaching lots of different subjects. Have you been surprised at, has the election, is it kind of a constant presence, or do you feel like they kind of forget about it?
I think it depends on
the news
proximity.
Cycle?
Yeah, and the news cycle. There are, I think, are a lot of our families are very tuned in. Like, I know my students, we don't ever watch any of the debates or any of the clips, but we have weekly, like, news articles and for our morning work. And so a lot of times it, like, right now it is covering the election. But a lot of our students do watch the debates at night with their families, which I think is, you know, if that's appropriate. Like, they can talk with their families about some of those more contentious issues. I haven't really seen them bring it in too much. More they're excited that they got to stay up late and
right.
watch the debate.
Yeah.
And they maybe, you know, that's sort of what they share as they're coming in the morning. I think that, like, there are some questions and they'll ask sort of informally before school starts. They try to make sense of it. We do a little bit of the news articles, or they'll say, you know, here's what I got from the debate.
I wonder, and it's interesting because you say you have news articles, and one thing we've heard from so many adults is how they actually don't believe news articles anymore. So I wonder, have you had kids say anything like that? Or do they just are like, oh, my teacher's giving this to me, I'm not going to question it?
I mean, they don't to me because I used to be a newspaper reporter before I became a teacher. So I don't know if they're trying to protect me or
you've just educated them about journalism.
Just
Alexis,
explain basic
right.
journalism. But I haven't seen that.
Yeah. And the articles that I use are more like this one says, issue overview, how the U.S. elects its presidents.
Okay. So it's a lot of education. Do you feel like this is a great opportunity? And Alexis, I don't know, in fourth grade, like what the kind of the goal is for civics education. What's your kind of hope of what the students will come out of this election and this year kind of learning about our governmental system?
Well, we kind of just touch on it. I think we had a similar conversation to Tiffany's conversation in our classroom when I set this article down for kids about a debate, the first debate. And we just sat down and talked, and I said that it was really wonderful that they're already so excited about voting and the electoral process. And I can tell that they're going to be very passionate voters. But I also encouraged them to try to get informed, and I explained why that was important. And sometimes we can feel like we like one candidate versus the other, but they really need to like get both sides of the picture, and then you can make an educated decision. I said, it's just the same like when we're writing an essay in English and you need to have your points from the text to support your claim. You want to do the same thing when you're looking for voting, whether it's a local issue or a state or national issue. You want to know where the candidates stand, and then you can make a decision and you can say it's because of these issues. And I really think that that's where I want them to leave, and knowing because the candidates are going to change,
mm-hmm.
you know, but being an informed voter, I think, is the most important part for them.
Is it a positive thing in your eyes that they're so excited about the election?
Yes.
You guys are both.
Yes.
And with this, you're having a mock election this week. How's that going to work?
They're going to use Chromebooks, so they're going to be on their computers and they're going to get to practice registering
to
vote.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Yeah.
Which is great because that's part of the process we want them to understand, that you need to register to vote. And after they've registered to vote, they'll be able to vote via a website. So
they kind of click on the candidate.
And then
they're
just voting for the president.
Yeah.
And have you focused on just the presidential race, or have you talked to them about all the other races that are happening?
I think most of the talk in my classroom has been on the presidential election. Later on in the fourth grade year, we do start covering a little bit of like local government and even how Greek government and Roman government influence our current government. But that kind of comes later, after the election cycle.
So the idea of having them register and all of that, did you guys come up with that? Is that part of the curriculum, or who came up with the idea of having was that you guys?
Yeah. It's just kind of extra. There's lots of little things that aren't officially part of it, but that, you know, you feel strongly about that will help your students become better citizens of the world when they leave.
And what's the plan for, what are you going to do after the election?
That's a really great question.
I guess it depends on the results of the election.
I was going to say, I think it depends on how the students react.
Right. That's a good... And do you have advice for parents in all of this? What do you say to your... I imagine, I don't know if you have parents coming in, but I know you guys have said, obviously, it's not your role. You're public school teachers. It's not your role, of course, to get involved in individual politics. But I think because of the bizarre nature of this election, you have a lot of kids expressing anxiety. There's a lot of topics that are frankly inappropriate for children to be discussing. But I'm sure that's up to the parents to try to figure out, like, do we want to talk about sexual assault and harassment with kids? You know, that's a very age appropriate and individual parental decision. But what advice do you have? Are parents coming to you?
I haven't had any parents.
No, I haven't.
And if parents
either,
are thinking about difficult conversations, like, do you feel like when kids are coming to you, like, I'm thinking of that kid who came to you and was worried, like, is my family going to be, you know, have to leave the country? Did you, like, is that something where you feel like, oh, maybe their family needs to know about this?
I think that maybe the best thing for all of us to do is really understand how our current government works and how, you know, how the local government works, how state level government works, even regional and national government. I feel like maybe we don't understand that well enough. So then we do have that fear because we have these systems in place to hopefully prevent some of those things. And so I think that the best thing that we can do is educate ourselves about the process and how things work and what the avenues would be if somebody wanted to pursue something like that. How could you combat that? And I think maybe my advice for parents is to kind of brush up. I mean, we all need a basic civics lesson. And that way, you know, when your kids come to you, you can explain, here's how the system works. And it's a system, so it's not always perfect. But here's the idea behind it.
That's Alexis McCann. She teaches fourth grade along with Tiffany Davis, who teaches fifth grade at Southside Elementary School in Champaign. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Every Monday we talk politics in these final weeks leading up to the election. We've been using this time to help you get your facts straight. We've been checking in with PolitiFact. They're a Pulitzer Prize winning website. They partnered with Reboot Illinois to create PolitiFact Illinois. Next Monday, the day before the election, we're going to be doing an entire hour of fact checking for you. The Washington Post fact checker is going to be joining us along with some folks from PolitiFact Illinois. If you have specific questions, specific facts that you haven't been clear about, email us. Talk@21stshow.org. You can tweet to our account, 21stshow. You can send us a Facebook message, search for the 21st, like us there. Joining us now, as always, the editor of the independent news site, Reboot Illinois, who's partnered with PolitiFact Illinois, Matt Dietrich, is with us. Hey, Matt, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to fact-checking, we saw Senator Kirk lose not just one, but two important endorsements over the weekend following statements from the debate last week, which I should say he's since apologized for the statement that he made. Representative Duckworth has accepted his apology, said, let's move on. But what happened over the weekend?
Well, what happened over the weekend was two groups that had endorsed Kirk previously, much to the surprise of a lot of observers when he got these endorsements, they rescinded their endorsements in the wake of Senator Kirk's remark about Representative Duckworth and her family heritage and her
and their military history.
Yeah. And these two, and it's not just that these weren't just kind of run-of-the-mill endorsements that were taken back. These were one group was the Human Rights Campaign, which is a national gay rights organization, and the other was the gun violence prevention organization that was founded by Gabby Giffords. And when Kirk initially got those two endorsements earlier this year, it kind of was a big deal, and it was a big plus for him because you would think that these two groups representing these two issues would naturally gravitate to the Democratic candidate. But as it turned out, you know, Kirk had taken a very public stand on gay marriage, and he attributed that to his recovery from his stroke, actually. And he also got the endorsement of this gun control group that was founded by Gabby Giffords, who was a Democratic U.S. representative like Tammy Duckworth is. So again, you would think that that endorsement would have automatically gone to Duckworth. Those two, though, were very important to Mark Kirk, because if he is going to win re-election, he needs to get a significant chunk of Democratic crossover voters. And these two groups in particular, these two endorsements, would appeal to that particular voting bloc. The Democrats who might be willing to cast a vote for a Republican for the Senate if he was moderate enough and proved himself open-minded enough. So to have them rescind these endorsements was not just a, you know, it wasn't just sort of a, oh, well, this is kind of what happens in politics sort of thing. It was a, more of a big deal than that, because these were fairly important and they were very high profile.
Let's will be interesting to see now, again, we're 8 days out, what kind of impact that may have. Matt, we've also, you and I have spent a little bit of time talking about the different ways that Donald Trump could affect major races. We've talked about the way Donald Trump, the fact that Senator Kirk broke very publicly with him quite early on, how that could affect, say, that race. But what about everybody else? What about if we're going to call it the Trump factor? I know you've been writing about this. Where do we see this on maybe as they, as the phrase we keep hearing over and over, down ballot, but not necessarily the presidential or Senate? Where else are we going to see this effect?
Well, what you have in a lot of, this doesn't happen so much in Chicago as much as it does in downstate and southern Illinois. You have a handful of Democratic incumbents who are serving in districts that went overwhelmingly for Governor Rauner in the 2014 election. Now, in those districts, the fact that Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is polling extremely well in those districts. So in those places, having Trump at the top of the ballot could be a big plus, because it could bring out those extra voters, those extra Republicans who may not have been quite so enthusiastic about voting for, you know, what they call an establishment Republican candidate. It might get them out to the polls. And the example that we've used a lot for one is down in Kankakee. You have a Democratic incumbent, Kate Clunan, and she won her last two elections. She won in 2014 by 122 votes. She won in 2012 by even less. So she's a Democrat. The Republicans and Governor Rauner, who's backing a lot of the Republican ad campaigns, see her as vulnerable. In that area, having Donald Trump there at the top of the ticket might be the factor that drives out that extra, you know, those extra 122 votes, for example.
I mean, there's narrows, or these margins are so small, and I'm thinking about, we're thinking about...
And also, and you know, you have, if you get into far southern Illinois, you have a few Democrats down there who are, they do very well locally, but their districts, you know, they went big time for Governor Rauner in the gubernatorial election 2 years ago. Donald Trump is polling very well down there. You know, you don't know if are the Trump voters going to come out in big numbers, and
The second part of that question is, are they going to, are they just going to vote for Donald Trump? Are they going to even vote for other races? Are they going to say, hey, I know, for example, Representative Rodney Davis has very publicly in the past couple of weeks said, I cannot support Donald Trump in the wake of the Access Hollywood video. He's been pretty outspoken about that. And I guess it's a big question as to, for Republican voters or other Trump supporters, if they would make that distinction or not.
Yeah, and Rodney Davis is he's running in a very, very Republican congressional district. He's not facing a super strong opponent.
He's an incumbent, now, of course, as well, which always gives him a break.
Right, and he was a staffer for John Shimkus before he ran for Congress. So, but he's very well known, and you know, if you followed this thing when he withdrew after the Access Hollywood video, and he went right onto Facebook and very explicitly and very publicly said, "I can't support this anymore. I have daughters, and you know, I can't in good conscience support this guy anymore. He got just, there were hundreds of Facebook comments just lambasting him for being a turncoat. Now, is that going to translate into people not voting for him? You know, you have to wonder in that case. However, you look down into the state races, state Senate.
What seats? What seats are, do you think, where it might make a difference? Other state Senate races, or state Senate or state House races? Are there other ones that kind of jump out to you in terms of Republicans who are fearful of saying yes or no in terms of Trump support?
Well, I think where it could help Republicans are where they're challenging in far southern Illinois, where you have a seat like Gary Forby.
And where's that seat, Matt? Gary Forby's seat? Where's that seat?
That is in that's in very far southern Illinois. I think that's Marion, maybe somewhere in that vicinity. That's one of those districts where you have Governor Rauner and his allies are really advertising heavily against the Democrats, the Democratic incumbents down there, and linking them with Mike Madigan. And I think that's where, if you bring that in, and if you have an energized Republican base in those districts, that's where you have to look at the possibility that Republicans could pick up a seat or two. Now, the other thing you have to take into account, and I've been saying this all along, is that, you know, conventional wisdom this year simply does not apply. Nobody was right about Donald Trump. You know, Nate Silver, the national statistician who became famous for his accuracy in the last two presidential elections, he totally missed Donald Trump. He dismissed him from the outset. And nobody thought that Donald Trump would actually end up being the nominee. Nobody thought he would actually win here in Illinois, where we're famous for moderate Republicans. So trying to apply conventional wisdom this year is pretty perilous, pretty risky.
That's Matt Dietrich. He is the editor of Reboot Illinois. Again, next Monday, which is the day before the election, in case anyone has forgotten, we are going to be doing a whole hour of fact-checking, because we know this has been such a contentious election, lots of people trying to understand the fact from fiction. PolitiFact Illinois is going to be joining us. We have the Washington Post fact-checker who's also going to be joining us. If you have a specific question, you can email us, talk@21stshow.org. That's 21st show. You can tweet to our account, 21st. ST Show. Send us a Facebook message. We will talk about the facts that you want checked next Monday for the entire hour. Matt Dietrich, as always, a pleasure. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
I feel pretty good seeing that Chicago is going back to Cleveland for Game 6. Really looking forward to see what they can do. Go Cubs.
I'm not a Cubs fan, I won't lie. Kind of jumping on the bandwagon. I know what it means for the Cubs to win this. Lived here a long time, know a lot of Cubs fan. I think it's big, and I love a good game.
It's big for Chicago. I'm kind of scared with it going back to Cleveland, because they've been hot in Cleveland. So.
Oh, they're going all the way now. Up until tonight, I was worried. Now I'm confident. I think they're going to win.
What makes you so confident?
They finally started hitting again. There were a couple games there that where they're just swinging at bad pitches, and they couldn't hit, and now they're hitting. So
you know, we're hoping for the bats to get started early, and hopefully they have a good outing with Jake Arrieta. Go Cubs.
You're listening to the 21st. Those were Cubs fans watching the game last night at Jupiter's at the Crossing in Champaign. Thanks to producer Christine Herman for that audio. I should say Cubs fans and bandwagon fans, because everybody's kind of in the same position now, cheering for the Cubs, who won their first World Series game at Wrigley Field since 1945 last night. The series will end in Cleveland. The Cubs need a win to survive Tuesday night, another on Wednesday to win the World Series. We're joined on the phone now by two folks from Chicago. Amar Madhani is USA Today's Chicago correspondent. He's been with us throughout the whole season. Amar, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
David Shaper is on the line with us as well. He's NPR's Midwest correspondent based in Chicago, was at Wrigley Field last night. David, thanks for being with us as well. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, and it's a pleasure to be here.
David, I know you've had a very late night, early morning. I know you've been. What was the atmosphere like last night? I know that it seemed like no one wanted to leave Wrigley Field last night. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. It was. I'm getting goosebumps just now, just thinking about it. You know, I mean, I like to be, you know, an objective journalist most of the time, but I'm born and raised a Cubs fan, and it's been a a huge Cubs fan my whole life, so it's got to be one of the top assignments I've ever had to be covering these games. And the atmosphere is just incredibly electric. It was just, I mean, people were on their feet almost the entire game. Any time, and I'm sure anybody who watched the game could see, any time that the Cubs just got two strikes on a hitter, one of the Cubs pitchers, everybody was on their feet waiting for that third strike or for a ground out or a pop out or whatever it was. What's funny is things have transpired over the years at Wrigley Field where it went from a place where people into baseball really went and studied the game to the largest outdoor beer garden in the world where half the people weren't even paying attention to the game. Well, that's totally changed now. Everybody was hanging on every pitch, and it was just an electric atmosphere. And like you said, it took a long time for them to, and maybe they weren't pushing people out, but people just stayed. They just wanted to you know, live in the moment.
Soak up that moment, right? Amar, you live pretty close to the park, right, in Wrigleyville?
I do.
And so I imagine you could hear all of that last night?
Oh, yeah. You know, the wind was blowing the right way last night, and I'm about six blocks away. And with the TV feed being a few seconds behind, I knew when something good was happening from the sound of the air.
Right. And there was one point, David, there was one point when Wrigley was sort of, I felt like the entire Wrigley Field was taunting the Indians pitcher and they were chanting. And I almost wanted to like open the door in champagne because I was like, I feel like I could almost hear this. Everyone's being so loud. But can you, David, can we talk about the energy shift a little bit? Because I think if we look back on the change from Friday to Saturday to Sunday, we went into Friday night thinking, or I went into Friday night at least thinking, the Cubs had a really good chance of taking that momentum and winning that game. Can you sort of talk about the emotional roller coaster that we have gone through this weekend?
After winning game two out in Cleveland on Wednesday night, I think a lot of Cubs fans thought, okay, the first game was an anomaly. We're going to be on task now. The Cubs are coming. You get to the ballpark, the wind, it was an incredibly warm night. The wind was blowing out. And Friday night, people thought, okay, we got this. We got one of our best pitchers, Jake Arrieta, going. And the wind's blowing out against one of their worst pitchers, starting pitchers. We're going to score a ton of runs. And that didn't happen. It was a pitcher's duel, neck and neck. They lose 1-0. That was a little bit deflating, but people thought, okay, well, we still have two more games at home. And the loss Saturday night, I think, really deflated people. And there are people leaving early Saturday night. There's a lot of dejected folks thinking, oh, boy, here we go again. And it's almost impossible if you've been a Cubs fan here for a long period of time to not have that feeling. As much as you try to fight it and think, oh, this team is different, people are just like, oh, man, really? Are we doing this again? And so people coming into the building, you could feel a little bit more of the tension in the building and a little bit more of that nervous energy. People were still excited, hopeful, but maybe we're done because the Indians could have wrapped it all up and walked away with the trophy. And it was phenomenal to see it just shift around during the course of that game.
Yeah. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. We're talking with NPR's David Shaper, USA Today's Chicago correspondent, Amar Madhani. Although I feel like, Amar, you're really here as our Super Cubs fan because you've been with us talking about this misery from the beginning of the season. So when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. We've also been talking to you guys on social media about what your Cubs superstitions are. So if you want to continue to tweet those, we've got a couple that we're going to read off in a little bit. If you feel comfortable sharing your superstitions on this Halloween, tweet to us at 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. If you want to give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. We're going to pick up this conversation in just a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the misery and the joy of being a Cubs fan. This World Series, my guests are Amar Madhani. He's a USA Today correspondent in Chicago. David Shaper is an NPR correspondent, also based in Chicago, was at yesterday evening's game. Amar, you know, we talked about, and David, I would love for you to weigh in after Amar. You grew up a Cubs fan. You live on the North Side. Maybe you can, what I haven't asked you about, because we haven't talked to you since they've gotten to the World Series, is what is this moment like for you? Because we were talking about sort of the misery that every Cubs fan lives with. Are you still kind of pinching yourself?
I am, but now it's also sort of this week of anguish now that going through this, the sleep deprivation, the sort of going up and down from, you know, the highs and lows of, as David was talking about and now I'm losing track of
Friday
days,
to Saturday to Sunday, sure.
Yeah, but after, yeah, going into Friday after winning game two, feeling that, all right, yeah, we're in a good place. And then seeing, you know, Friday, I think, was a fantastic game where the Indians were just a little bit of a better team that day. And then on Saturday, they were a way better team. And then yesterday was great.
Well, the first half of the game, I was also pretty worried. I mean, I don't know how you felt about it. I felt a little sick for easily the first couple of innings of yesterday's game.
And the last three, those last eight outs.
Right.
You know, gut-wrenching. So, right at this moment, I sort of feel this, like a sleep-deprived new father. That's like the closest sort of experience that I've had to what I'm feeling right now physically.
David, is that an accurate depiction?
you know, it really is. It's interesting because as a new dad, you've got all this excitement and you are so happy, and yet you're so anxious, like, oh my God, can I really do this? Can I be a dad? Can I take care of this small little infant child? And you have all the angst that goes with that. And that's what it's like watching these games. You're just kind of, maybe it's not the exact same comparison, but it really is. You do hang on every pitch. You just, you know, it's the emotional roller coaster. It has actually surprised me a little bit. I mean, I've been a big baseball fan and Cubs fan my whole life, but you know, remembering back, my grandmother was the one who was a really true blue Cubs fan and kind of, you know, got us all hooked on the Cubs, despite the fact that her son, my father, was a Sox fan, you know, because Sox, when he in the 40s and 50s, were a way better team than the Cubs, and that's the team that he followed and cheered on. So remembering her and remembering, you know, the afternoons in the 70s and 80s of the games on the TV in her house on a black and white TV, and, you know, listening to the games on the radio, and how she would talk about certain players of that time and then years before, really brings a flood of emotion. So, you know, I'm getting texts from all my siblings all around the country.
Well, and I love how all of your cousins are posting on Facebook how they're so proud of you that you're at Wrigley Field for the game.
Yeah,
David, that's my favorite part is seeing all of your relatives posting on your page, like, we're so proud of you. You're covering the game at Wrigley Field. Amar, what about you? I mean, your family, I mean, it's interesting. I know we talked about this. I think it was the first time we talked at the beginning of the season about how you sort of grew up as a Cubs fan, but also as a sort of as a child of immigrants who weren't necessarily, like, your dad wasn't necessarily like a baseball guy.
Right. And they left the country this week. So, they are totally not interested at all. I think they watched part of game one or game two last week before heading out. But it's just not that big a deal to them. And I remember my father, at one point, I think it was soon after talking to you earlier in the season when they'd gone off to the 25-6 start, and he'd seen a column that I'd written about sort of my optimism, and he said, you know, they always disappoint you in the end.
No.
And so he's sort of the harsh realist about about the Cubs.
Well, and let me ask you, both of you guys, is it so much like the Cubs for them to be down 3-1 in the World Series and have to dig themselves out? I was so optimistic going into Friday thinking we have three games. This is going to be so great. But then, as you know, lots of Cubs fans are just shrugging and saying, of course, this is how it would play out. That now this is sort of a do or die for the next two games in Cleveland. David?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. You know, it is kind of just one of those things. We can never really make it easy, can we? It's got to be gut-wrenching, and you've got to be sitting at the edge of your seat. If you're sitting at all, you're on your feet. And, you know, my son, he was pacing throughout the house, you know, after Saturday's loss. he was just miserable, and I was like, oh, my God, what have I done to my son? I've cursed him with this love of the Cubs. And it's just... It is that, but at the same time, I feel like, and I really got this vibe, you know, as much as there was a little bit of a down note going into the game last night, it's nowhere near the angst and the, oh my God, we're gonna blow it again, that I felt back in 2003, that I felt back in 2007 and 8, and other years where they just fell apart. This team is really different, and the fans know it, the team knows it, that they're a better ball club through and through. They're deeper. They're more talented at most every position. And they really have the right mindset. And that comes from the leadership of the club, and particularly Joe Maddon, the manager, who has them loose and having fun and not getting all caught up in all the angst of every moment.
You know, David, I want to get to, it is Halloween. You mentioned cursing, and I wanted to get to superstitions and curses in a minute. But let me just ask you one thing, because you mentioned Joe Maddon. It was so interesting last night to see the Cubs, to see Joe Maddon kind of bring in Aroldis Chapman, the closer, for three innings, so which is kind of unusual to have a closer pitch for that long. Normally, and especially Chapman, normally throws just one inning. Do you think we're going to see a lot of unusual moves like that by Joe Maddon in Game 6? What are you anticipating?
I think we will, and we have. I think that it's the World Series. It's the last game. The backs were up against the wall. You got to pull out all the stops to get that win. I saw actually both managers managing in a different way than we usually see. They weren't staying with their starters as is the tradition through 5, 6, 7, 8 innings. We saw guys who were having success pulled after 4 innings or 5 innings. And, you know, the idea is that the freshest arms, the strongest arms, you know, matching up what pitcher is most likely to get which hitter out. And if that means you just face one guy or two guys, that's it, you know. And I think Terry Francona of the Indians, you know, putting my objective hat back on, has done a masterful job in this series of trying to match pitchers with Cub hitters at the right time and keeping the Cub hitters off balance, and at the same time countering with his pinch hitters at the right time. You know, putting in Coco Crisp at the time Friday night was a move I think some people questioned, but he came through. He got the one base hit that scored the one run, and that helped up to win the game.
Well, and you've got to say, no matter what side you're on, last night was a really great game. It was such an entertaining game for everybody to watch. There's really great baseball that we're seeing. As for someone, baseball is not, I'm not a huge baseball fan. It was a game that I really enjoyed. Amar, would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I think both games 3 and game 5, one went the Indians' way. Game 3 was, I think, equally a great game that I wish went the Cubs' way. But yeah, yesterday's game just had everything. It had the Cubs going down and coming back with, you know, you could feel as the emotional ups and down, and then having Chapman come in for 2 2/3. And as great as he is, seeing him go in the second longest outing in his career on the biggest stage, you know, it just had all the elements of a great game.
Right. More great moves with Javi Baez catching some incredible catches. Okay, so let's talk about superstitions, because it's Halloween, and we've been talking to people on social media about what their Cubs superstitions are. My favorite was the Reddit user who said blue underwear, but we heard lucky chairs, same table at the same bar. Our WILL Morning Edition host will not take off his Cubs hat. What superstitions do you guys have? Amar?
I don't have any superstitions.
Oh, that's good. You don't have any.
I'm enforcing a superstition on a friend of mine who's been wearing the same socks for every Cubs game throughout the playoffs.
Oh, just the playoffs. Okay. I thought you were going to say the whole season.
No, just through the playoffs. But they haven't been clean through the playoffs. So, he's taken one for the team.
David, what about you? David, do you have superstitions?
You know, I don't have, you know, I do have a pair of blue Cubby boxers that I've been wearing pretty much every game. But clearly they haven't worked every time. They're getting a workout in the washing machine. I will wash them after each time, but you know, it's like, it is, you know, it's like crap, there's another game tonight. Do I have enough other clothes to wash to run a full load? You know, there have been things that I've thought, what's really funny is I covered the NLCS in 2003. When the famous Bartman game happened and people
remind everybody, David, for people who don't know what happened.
So there's the Cubs were up 5 outs from going into the World Series. I think the Florida Marlins, who they were playing at the time, maybe had a guy on base or two. There was a foul pop up just along the left field line. Over by the stands, and Moises Alou, the left fielder, came over to try to make the catch, and a bunch of fans reached up and grabbed it, and the ball was deflected. It looked like it was this guy with headphones on and a cap, blue cap, named Steve Bartman, had deflected it, and kept Alou from getting that critical out. On the very next play, there was a ground ball to the shortstop that was an error that would have been an inning-ending double play. Turned out that allowed a run, and then the whole roof caved in, and then the Cubs kept scoring runs after that, or the Marlins did, and they won that game, and then they came back and won game 7 the following night. What's really funny is how many people didn't really quite see the Bartman play that I talked to after the game and thought that they had done something to jinx it, either celebrating too soon or, you know, I was calling my brother who's way off in some faraway land and let him know we've done it, we've won it, you know, but prematurely. Some guys I met who had been in the bleachers had snuck in a couple of bottles of champagne, and one of them just couldn't help himself and had to pop it.
Oh, so he was like, "I'm the one who cursed the Cubs."
Yeah, and they couldn't really see what was going on there, and you know, TB spent so much time, and everybody outside of the park was focused on this one guy, and certainly a lot of people who sat in that area were. And in particular, the tantrum that Moises Alou threw on the field after he didn't get the ball because he knew it would be a critical play. It was just fascinating to see how many Cubs fans just thought that no, it wasn't the players on the field, the idiot shortstop who booted an easy double play ball. It wasn't the the pitchers who couldn't get anybody out after that. It was me.
So I don't know if it's bad luck to even ask this question. We just have about 2 minutes left, so you guys don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But do you feel like, at least at a minimum, having won a World Series game at Wrigley Field, does that mean that you think the curse of the Billy Goat may be broken, Amer? You're really thinking hard about this.
I guess, you know, I think just making it in a lot of ways, you know, I think most serious Cubs fans, you know, pay minimum amount of attention to, you know, a hamburger salesman who created the greatest marketing ploy of, you know, modern times. Like, think about how much cheap advertising the Cyanis family has gotten out of this Billy Goat.
Right.
But I think, you know, there was a huge amount of pressure and anxiety that was taken off of the franchise and of Cubs fans by just making it to the World Series.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to see them win, but I think they're now on this trajectory of this is a great franchise, and I hope it works out over these next two games. But this is a team that is going to and should be good for, you know, the next 5 to 7 years.
David, you've got 30 seconds. Yes or no, you think the curse is
You know what, I would agree with that assessment. I've never put much stock in a curse. I mean, I think a lot of Cubs fans, yeah, were jinxed or cursed, but I think people personalize it more than this one Billy Boater.
Everyone thinks everything they're doing. Right.
Right, right. But this is a team, especially making it over that hump that and getting into the World Series, that and it's built in such a different way. And these guys don't really know about or don't care about the past. I think it really sets up this franchise for several years of success and maybe a few World Series titles, even if they don't win it this year.
David Shaper from NPR, USA Today's Amar Madhani. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Have a great day. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.